Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2017. Today we're joined by one of my favorite Valentines, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How you doing, D.R.?
You're all hurt.
Oh, goodness. So here we are, the ongoing whirlwind of stuff. But there was something that was slightly more, less news, instant news cycle, and more of a topical, timeless thing that happened this past week. As you know, DR, you and I have spoken often about the need for a carbon price. And of course, what we mean by a carbon price is basically having to pay some extra amount of money when you buy oil or gas or any of that stuff, some extra amount of money that basically accounts for the damage that fossil fuel is going to make in the world, right? That's the price. You're paying a price for the upfront. You're paying a price for the damage that you're going to do by burning that fossil fuel. And of course, having a high carbon price discourages the use of those fossil fuels and sends us all in a good direction from a sort of Adam Smith market, what did he call it? Secret market? No, the invisible hand of the market, right? And of course, this is sometimes called a carbon tax. Mm-hmm. And there have been efforts for a long time to promote a carbon tax as being the most sensible way to fight climate change, because the market gets to do whatever it wants to do because the price of fossil fuels is so high. That all of a sudden windmills look great. But tell me, DR, I'll let you take over the story from here. What this week, what was the latest turn in the carbon tax story that might surprise people?
Well, in an event that got, frankly, far more coverage than most events related to climate change usually get in the mainstream media, in what we call the corporate media, a group of former officials from the Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush administration under the name of the Climate Leadership Council announced a plan and had a meeting with various officials in the Trump administration to discuss what they call a conservative climate policy. And the four prongs of the policy would be, number one, a gradually rising federal carbon tax that would begin at $40 a ton and increase steadily over time. Number two, having all collected revenues from the carbon tax being returned to the public as a dividend being administered by the Social Security Administration. Number three, a border adjustment so that there would be effectively a tariff placed on imports from a country that did not impose its own carbon taxes. And number four, the complete elimination of the EPA's regulatory authority over CO2, including an outright repeal of the Clean Power Plan, and perhaps most controversially, a permanent immunity from any fossil fuel company being held legally liable for damage that they caused or may have caused, which is in some circles regarded as a way of trying to appeal to conservative voters and conservative policymakers by effectively killing off the Exxon New movement, which would be the practical effect of this policy proposal. There has been some debate and some pushback, most notably a well thought out pushback by David Doniger of the Natural Resources Defense Council, who in particular raised a red flag about the attempted, elimination of legal liability for the fossil fuel companies. And again, it is perhaps because of the nature of the proposal and who's doing the proposal tends to get a lot more coverage than usually other things.
You or I said it.
Yeah, it was just a highly unusual, involving op-eds by the various officials from this group in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal on the same day. Mm-hmm. When's the last time I cannot remember the last time both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal on the same day ran editorials in favor of climate action. Usually it will be the Wall Street Journal running the anti-position, right. But they both ran similar op-eds on the same day. So
basically this GOP plan mirrors in many but not all respects a classic what's called a fee and dividend model that has mm-hmm. been pushed by progressives and climate hawks for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. You collect definitely. All the money and then you give it back to each social security number, basically. Mm-hmm. So the magic behind giving it back to each social security recipient is that that if you as an individual person use less than the average amount of fossil fuels, you are making money. Right? Mm-hmm. So the incentive is there for you to improve your energy efficiency so you get to keep more and more of that money. If mm-hmm. you use exactly the average amount of fossil fuels, it's a wash. Mm-hmm. And if you use more than the average amount of fossil fuels, you're losing money. Right? And again, mm-hmm. you have an incentive to cut back.
Yes.
So, I mean, this GOP conservative plan in that vein was pretty much consistent with progressive plans, but as mm-hmm. you say, the difference being that somehow there's this, I don't know, sweetheart deal with the corporate America, right? So they mm-hmm. make the President Obama's climate plan go away mm-hmm. and to exonerate Exxon from any, inoculate them from anything else, right?
Mm-hmm.
So do you think, go ahead.
Yes, that's definitely the contours of this plan. And to the question of whether this will go anywhere, to answer that question, we do have to look at some of the remarks and some of the history of particularly one of the officials involved in this plan, which is a fellow by the name of James Baker, who was Secretary of State for George H.W. Bush, who stated in a press conference announcing this plan that he wasn't sure if Trump would respond favorably to it, but he's not sure why not, because it's a fairly conservative plan. My theory is that these individuals, especially Baker, know darn well that Trump is not going to respond favorably to this, that Steve Bannon is not going to respond favorably to this, and it's unlikely that congressional Republicans are going to respond favorably to this. But I think the idea here is that it is being there. We cannot ignore the hands of politics here. The individuals who were involved in crafting this policy understand recent political history. George Shultz, who was involved in this, he was Reagan's Secretary of State. He saw what Reagan's hardcore anti-environmental position did to his popularity in his first administration, and how that could have really prevented Reagan from becoming reelected. James Baker saw what George H.W. Bush's reluctance to take a firm stance on climate did to his prospects for reelection, and Greg Mankiw and Henry Paulson, who were involved with the George W. Bush administration in the 2000s, they saw the aftermath of what Katrina and the inconvenient truth and the increased speculation mm-hmm. in Bush's second term of Bush's inaction on climate did to him, after Bush had been warned in his first term by his Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and by his first EPA Administrator Christine Todd Whitman. He was warned, if you don't take action, if you don't formulate a policy to reduce carbon pollution, you're going to suffer the political consequences. And indeed he did, and indeed his party did in 2006 and 2008. Mm-hmm. So my theory is that
you think they're trying to save him.
I think this is an advisory. I think this is a warning sign, letting Trump know, putting Trump on notice, to use Michael Flynn's line, that if he goes all in, and if Pruitt goes all in, and if that crew this basket of deplorables that wants to gut all vestiges mm-hmm. of wants to destroy 50 years of environmental protection, if they try to do that and then simply try to do nothing, if they try not to put together any sort of policy to replace what they have gotten away with, they will suffer the political consequences. He may well be a one-term president, and his party will suffer political consequences as well.
Well, I guess that it seems to me that the mere fact that these people are talking about it gives credibility to the concept of a carbon tax. And I think in that sense, it's good. I agree with you. It's a non-starter and it may be a warning. I have zero confidence that Donald Trump will ever absorb these warnings. I mean, the guy is nuts. But for me, I guess the question, one of the questions that comes up about the carbon tax, and you and I have touched on this before, is the conflict, it seems to me, between a straight return of the carbon tax revenue to individual citizens versus a more equitable redistribution of that revenue to communities that have suffered from various kinds of environmental injustices and whatnot over time. I mean, at the end of the show, I'll say it again, that we need a long-term and equitable price on carbon. And the question is, how do you think this plan is equitable? I mean, do you think a straight per capita return of the revenues is an equitable path? Or do you think that we need to take some of that money and, I don't know, clean up the power plant in South Central L.A. or, I don't know?
You touch upon a very interesting issue. And remember, this came up in the debate last year in Washington State over I-732. And the reason it failed was because, in part, some climate hawks basically said that, you know, that a certain proportion of the revenue should be invested in clean energy, in green jobs, and this is why, as we've mentioned before, 4 years ago when Barbara Boxer and Bernie Sanders proposed their own carbon pricing legislation, they set aside, I believe, 40% of the revenue for investment in clean energy and clean jobs. If I had to guess, I think the thought process of the people who crafted this is that what even if you could convince the people who crafted this that a more equitable policy would be to invest in clean energy and clean jobs, I think they would argue that in the right wing mind, that's picking winners and losers, that's redistributing wealth, and that stuff that will automatically shut down the conversation the right. And if they're pitching this as something that a right-wing administration would respond to, you can imagine, based on, frankly, the history of the campaigning of Trump and the history of what Bannon would do, if you said, you know, propose to Trump and Bannon something that will invest in underserved communities, that would make the prospects that are already at zero less than zero in terms of a favorable response from Trump and Bannon.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hear you. I guess I'm thinking, though, in terms of a pure philosophical approach, right? Put aside Trump's Mr. Loofah face, right? Put that whole thing aside. If you're going to have the a carbon fee, it seems to me, on the one hand, a strictly, absolutely fair, equal return to every citizen is the simplest thing to sell by far. It is intuitively appealing because it's intuitively fair, right, without thinking about it too much. And it creates an incredible constituency that wants to get that quarterly paycheck, right? It'll never go away. Flip side is that the equal distribution of the money from a different perspective is inherently unfair, right? There are people that have, as I say, are living next to people in Flint, right? to give them their, you know, an equal per capita share of the money seems like an unfair way to go. And so I guess I'm really confused. I probably need to think more, but it's a fit topic for discussion in philosophical contemplation as to how you best structure a thing to be, what was the guy, the philosopher of the 1850s about utilitarianism, right? You want the greatest happiness for the most number of people. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, and this goes back to a point that the radio host Sam Cedar made back in October, where he noted that part of the reason why climate hawks who were opposed to I-732 were doing so, that was a strategic and deliberate strategy on the part of those climate hawks to kill the idea of full revenue neutrality, full rebating of a carbon fee, precisely because they understood that whatever came out of Washington State would be replicated nationally. And if you could stop the full distribution or, you know, in terms of tax cuts and what have you, and basically precipitate a situation where what would be spread nationally would be something where money would be set aside for investment in clean energy. That would be the better strategy. Because remember, the argument from these climate hawks was that merely putting a price on carbon does not guarantee a reduction in carbon emissions. Merely putting a price on carbon does not guarantee investment in clean energy, so that any sort of national or nationalized policy would by necessity have to set aside a certain percentage of the revenue for investment in clean energy, investment in green jobs, and what have you. So there is a possibility that under different circumstances, under a different political climate, if in fact there was a bill that began with a 100% rebated carbon fee, presumably in the name of making sure it passes with the votes that it would need to pass, it would have to be modified back into a version of the Boxer-Sanders bill from 2013.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting final point here. I guess this interesting distinction you make is that a cap, the carbon fee and dividend provides price, confidence about the price of fossil fuel, which will be going down. But if someone, will be going up. But if somebody wants to pay the price, they can have more emissions, right? Mm-hmm. The only thing that's certain from a business perspective is the price is going up. In contrast, a cap and trade system, which had its day in court, and we can talk about another, the cap and trade system guarantees a limit on emissions, and the price is free to vary. It's just an interesting contrast between the two approaches. Either one would be a good thing, right? Much better off than we are now, but it's two different approaches to how to put a price on carbon. So, DR, so there's that. Let's put that aside because that is a topic of great discussion. The other thing that we wanted to get to was to talk a little bit about a kerfuffle around NOAA this past week. So can you tell me what happened there?
Yes, this was a manufactured controversy, some alternative facts and fake news coming out of a godfather of fake news, a fellow by the name of David Rose, who has a thorny reputation for making crap up about climate change. He writes out of the tabloid known as the UK Daily Mail. And according to John Abraham of The Guardian, in his piece, quote, Rose claimed that scientists used misleading data in a 2015 paper that debunked the notion that climate change somehow stopped in 1998. Rose obtained information from someone who had worked at NOAA to imply that internal review procedures were not followed as the paper was prepared for publication. Of course, the thing is that the work from the 2015 paper had been already been independently verified by other researchers, and the source David Rose relied upon, of Mr. Bates, I believe John Bates, I think his name is, that source was never involved in any part of the work, and as John Abraham also notes, quote, the attack piece also claims that scientists discarded high-quality temperature measurements in favor of low-quality data. This claim is demonstrably false, unquote. And subsequently, there was another piece in The Guardian written by Dana Nucitelli in which he talked to this so-called whistleblower, this John Bates, and Bates told, in which he noted that according to E&E News, Bates stated, quote, the issue here is not an issue of tampering with data, but rather really of timing of a release of a paper that not properly disclosed everything it was. And Bates later told Science Insider, quote, I knew people would misuse this, but you can't control other people, unquote. And the fact that Mr. Bates says, I knew people would misuse this, means that when he spoke to David Rose, he knew, he had to have known what the Dinosaur industry was going to do with this. So basically, you know, even though he's trying to disavow his own role in this shameful mess, he really can't, because he's the person who loaded the gun that David Rose used to shoot down science.
And the whole thing is, seems like it's a tempest in a teapot, but this kind of continuous pot boiling stuff goes straight to the House Committee on Science, and this guy named Lamar Smith, who uses it just to sort of keep confusion and give people a talking point. And it's a terrible thing. This whole thing has been debunked. If you hear about a NOAA report that's called into question, you can immediately say that it is a bunch of hogwash. Didn't happen. The NOAA report stands true, and it's almost pointless to try and argue against the crazy distortions because you're in. Anyway, so DR, here's a different story. last week, last time we spoke, we talked a little bit about the amount of information coming at people. And what we were talking about is telling folks who might listen to this podcast that may want to go search for some of the original information themselves that you and I try and collate. And basically, the question is, what websites do you frequent? I mean, where do you go to find out stuff about climate? I mean, when you're interested, which I know is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
there are a number of different sites. ClimateCrocs.com by Peter Sinclair, who's been for a decade debunking climate change denial claims. There's the Climate Deregulation Tracker, a new site at ColumbiaClimateLaw.com, which is analyzing what Trump and his minions in the House and Senate are doing to sort of roll back environmental protections. There's obviously BetsyRosenberg.com by my former radio colleague at the Progressive Radio Network, who has this huge chronicle of climate news and interviews. There's also the Green News Report by Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, which we found at bradblog.com, which is a great bi-weekly compendium of climate news. And there's just, there are just so many great, you know, writers and blogs. They're almost too many to list, basically. But in a time when, you know, we see this, you know, generally, this issue still not receiving the focus it deserves to receive, and to the extent that it's received an increased focus in the last couple of weeks, it's only in terms of covering, you know, the sort of extreme actions of the current administration. I mean, the bloggers and the writers who get it right. I would mention Dana Nucitelli, who's the gentleman that wrote the follow-up piece on the NOAA controversy. He's another great writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the ones you can rely upon.
All right. And if you're on Twitter, once you pick those guys up on the blogs, you go to Twitter and follow their tweets, and you can sort of also pick up information that way. Mm-hmm. Okay, DR, thank you very much for that information. Let me remind everybody, if I haven't already, that on Sunday, March 5th, at the Curry Center of Northeastern University on Huntington Avenue in Boston, will be the annual MCAN conference in collaboration with the Toxics Action Center. You can go to localenvironmentalaction.org, all one word, and sign up. The early bird special is still on. It's a great conference. You will learn a lot. You'll meet other climate activists, and at the end of the day, you'll feel much better about yourself and the prospects for the world, because you'll know that you're not the only one, and there's other people you've connected with that care about this topic as much as you do. Mm-hmm. So, DR, let me, we'll put up links to all this stuff. There's a lot of it, but we'll try to do our best to put up the links to it. The links will be on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. You'll also find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. Of course, you can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, yada, yada, yada. We're all over the place. If we are not on a podcast service that you like, let us know. We'll try and get on it. Of course, we're on iTunes. So, DR, we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, you must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So, DR, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.
Very cool.